Welcome to Creating Sanctuary, a global interview series featuring 21 heroes who are saving animals' lives. I'm your host, Yolanda Calderon, and the hero I'm interviewing today is Bruce Wagman. He is a founder of Project Chimps, and he's a partner in Schiff Hardin's San Francisco law office with an almost exclusive focus on animal law matters. He has dedicated his career to defending and improving animals' lives. He represented two sanctuaries in the successful battle to keep two chimpanzees and nine gibbons in their new supportive homes. Welcome, Bruce. I'm so happy that you could join us.
Oh, thanks so much, Yolanda. Glad to be here.
So you've combined your unique professional skills to not only create one or more sanctuaries, but also to negotiate for the release of the chimpanzees there, and you've also dedicated your work to helping animals. So can you tell us about the beginnings of that first sanctuary and then specifically talk about some of the chimpanzees there?
Sure. So the first sanctuary, chimpanzee sanctuary I was involved in is called Chimpanzee Sanctuary Northwest. It's in Clay Elum, Washington. They've got seven chimpanzees, and I helped negotiate their release from a biomedical research facility in Pennsylvania, and they've been there since 2008, six females and one male at Chimpanzee Sanctuary Northwest. Then Project Chimps is in Blue Ridge, Georgia. We opened in 2015, got our first chimpanzees in 2016, and are up to 40 now and expect to have over 200 by the time we are done. Project Chimps has a total of 236 acres. Currently, our phase one construction has a six-acre forested habitat for the chimpanzees to roam around in, climb trees, play, forage during the day, and play with others as well, other chimps, obviously.
Lovely. Yeah, I saw the map on your website of the facility, and it looks amazing, all these different little villages, right?
Villas. So we have the current phase one, what we call phase one, has five villas or four villas and a group building, and they all encircle the six-acre habitat. And so they get to go into that habitat, which is actually split in half during the day, and the phases two, three, and four probably will each house about another 50 chimps, where phase one will house about 80 chimps.
Mm-hmm. So you were telling me that no more chimpanzees are being used for research in this country. Where are those chimps that are waiting to come to you right now, and what's happening with them right now?
Well, some of them are the ones that Project Chimps is involved with are at a place called the New Iberia Research Center in New Iberia, Louisiana, which is the research center connected with the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. And so they've been there, and they will be moving to Project Chimps slowly but surely as we expand. And other chimpanzees in America who were used in research are in federally owned facilities for the most part around the country. There's one or two other smaller labs that may have some private chimps.
And what's happening with them now? Like, what are their conditions right now?
Well, they're being cared for by the people who essentially own them and have used them in the past for research. And same with the ones at the federal level, they're being cared for there.
What did it take to start that initial sanctuary?
Took a team of dedicated volunteers and employees and staff and chimpanzee experts especially. That's what it took for both of them. And it took a negotiation with the folks who had the chimpanzees to get an agreement to get them out and bring them to the sanctuaries.
What agreement was it that passed that made it illegal to...
Not an agreement. It's a law. It's called the Endangered Species Act, and it's a change
okay,
in the
you.
Endangered Species Act that... The two had nothing to do with each other. They were completely divorced from each other. They're just coincidental. The chimpanzees from Chimpanzee Sanctuary Northwest were transferred long before the Endangered Species Act was changed, and the negotiations for Project Chimps began also before the law was changed, although the law changed sort of in the middle of our negotiations.
So you had been advocating for these chimps while it was still legal?
Correct.
To do research with them, and then...
Absolutely.
And then the Endangered Species Act changed so that they would have ended up being released at some point.
Not released, just not researched on. The fact that they can't be researched on doesn't change the fact that they are owned by the labs who use them. So that doesn't, it just means you can't research on them. It doesn't mean you can't keep them.
Right, and it doesn't specify the conditions that they're in.
Well, the conditions that they're in are specified by law, by essentially, for the most part, by a law known as the Animal Welfare Act, which is a federal law which governs the conditions of habitation of great apes or especially chimpanzees, as well as other policies and procedures of some of the labs. But the Animal Welfare Act is the main law, along with the Endangered Species Act to some degree, that governs their treatment.
Uh-huh. So what's the advocacy program at Chimp Sanctuary Northwest that you helped found?
Well, it's just basically, especially since that started many years before the Endangered Species Act was amended, advocating for, at that point, an end to research on chimpanzees, and then also advocating for public education about chimpanzees in entertainment and how that's a really bad thing, chimpanzees in private ownership, so not labs, but people sometimes foolishly think that it would be nice to have a chimpanzee as a pet, so advocating against that, the use of them in the media, that kind of thing.
And is it legal to have chimpanzees as pets now?
In some states, it's still legal, so yeah. It depends on the ownership of wild animals is a state-by-state issue, so it depends on the state you're in.
Were the chimpanzees that were used for research, were they bred for that, or were they actually taken from the wild?
Both. Most of the ones that we have so far, I'm not 100% positive, but I'm pretty sure most of them were bred for research. So there was some breeding for a while, and then the feds shut down the breeding or were no longer allowed to, there was no longer breeding allowed at the federal level. So, but initially, early on, chimpanzees who were used in research were taken from the wild right up to, mm-hmm. to pretty recently.
Wow. So you work mostly on animal cases. So are there any cases that you can share with us that you're working on right now or that you've worked on in the past that would be interesting?
Yeah, you got 6 hours. let's see. Yeah, done a bunch of cases involving animal hoarding. So had a case in North Carolina where we rescued 350 dogs who were being kept in horrendous conditions, horrific conditions, living in feces and urine, their eyes burning out, their teeth falling out, being kept by a woman who's classified as an animal hoarder or animal collector, helped get them out. I've been heavily involved in a lot of farm animal work. So in general, that is takes on two aspects, but the main aspect is helping get laws passed that give greater protection to farm animals, and by that I mean for the most part chickens and pigs and cows, and then mm-hmm. defending those laws when usually industry advocates try to get them struck down. So I've been involved in, I think, 5 or 6 lawsuits protecting the move towards prohibition on what are known as battery cages, tiny cages used for egg-laying hens. Mm-hmm. Been involved in several cases involving pigs and the use of gestation crates, which are very intensive confinement, tough conditions for pigs, as well as a couple cases involving foie gras. I've also been involved in cases upholding the shark fin ban in California. Mm-hmm. And then some Endangered Species Act work, so couple of cases protecting wolves or trying to protect wolves, also mm-hmm. mountain lions, definitely chimpanzees, some elephants, and then a bunch of individual dog and cat cases, so dog and cat custody as well as dog bites and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's just sort of off the top of my head.
Amazing. So can you talk about this initiative that Prevent Cruelty California is working on to get that on the ballot? Can you clarify what they're trying to do, what the conditions are now to change
sure.
for farmed
yeah, sure.
animals?
Sure. So In 2008, California passed what was known then, or still known as Prop 2, in a voter initiative, so a ballot initiative, not a legislative enactment, but a popular vote by the people. Prop 2 got a greater percentage of the vote than any voter initiative to date, up to that date in California, up to 2008, and more votes than President Obama, even. That law changed things so that it put a ban on three different types of intensive confinement in humane conditions. One was battery cages, so you no longer could have battery cages, which essentially a battery cage takes about 6 to 8 hens, puts them in a wire cage where they're standing on slanted wire mesh for their entire lives. They can't move or turn around, and their eggs come out and go into a conveyor belt, and there's tens of thousands of them in each given building. It also prohibited gestation crates that I mentioned, which are tight metal stanchions which prevent sows, mother pigs, from moving at all. They can stand up and lay down, but they can't turn around, and they're forced to lie in their own feces and urine for their entire lives. And it also banned veal crates, what we call veal crates, which are tight confinement for veal calves, young cows who are used to make veal. And by keeping them from moving and giving them a restricted diet, the veal that comes from their flesh is supposedly better tasting. So that was Prop 2, passed in 2008. It didn't go into effect until, I think, 2015. Yeah, it had a 7-year phase-in. And Prop 2 required that every animal who's kept in confinement would be able to stand up, lie down, and turn around without touching another animal or the sides of the cage, of the enclosure. And so it did not require cage-free hens, which was something that a lot of people wanted, but it didn't require that. And so the new initiative that you mentioned will require cage-free as opposed to still allowing for enclosures. And there's also a sort of a parallel law that was created or written into the legislature parallel to Prop 2, which made it illegal to sell any eggs in California that didn't come from hens that were treated the same way that California hens had to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
So every egg in California has to come from a hen who has lived in conditions such as Prop 2 requires. And the new initiative will change that by requiring cage-free.
Okay. So there are not any gestation crates being used in California now because of Prop 2?
That's correct, since 2015.
Oh, I didn't realize that. And so this new initiative, will that also change for the pigs?
No, it's only cage-free for hens, I believe. It's just for hens.
Because that would be huge if it would prohibit any pork being sold in California that had the same standards.
Right. Now, well, that it may do, but I'm not sure. I don't think it requires, I guess what I was saying was it doesn't require cage-free as opposed to, you know, just requiring, giving them a little bit more room to walk around, if you will. So the new initiative that we're talking about will prevent what you were just suggesting, just to be clear. It will prevent pork from being sold in California that does not comply with the required treatment of pigs in California.
Great.
So no gestation crates. It's not cage-free, but it's no gestation crates.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And the same thing with the veal crates. So
same with the veal crates and the same with eggs as well.
Excellent.
Right.
Excellent. So that's actually quite important. And what other farmed animal work are you doing?
There are two different cases in which 12 different states have actually sued, 12 different states have sued California and 11 different states have sued Massachusetts over these laws. And Massachusetts has very similar laws to actually the new initiative here in California. Massachusetts is a very recent law. And so a bunch of states have sued the states that enacted these laws, so California and Massachusetts. So I'm involved in work on those two cases. And then I'm sort of regularly involved in just consultation and discussion about farm animal policy and farm animal legal issues.
You mentioned a couple of other interesting cases. Have you worked on any cases involving donkeys or wild burros?
Oh, see, there you go. That's what we forgot about. I've only spent like half of the last 5 years working on horse cases. So, seriously, like for 2012 to 13, probably 80% of my work was actually around horse slaughter. So I was involved in a team that sued the federal government and other entities to stop horse slaughter for human consumption beginning again in America. And I spent the last 10 years at least doing cases under the Wild Free Rolling Horse and Burros Act. And how I forgot that at the beginning of my list, I don't know. And my client would hit me. But anyway, yeah, I do a lot of wild horse and burros work as well as, like I said, the horse slaughter, as well as horse cruelty.
And horse slaughter is not exactly illegal in this country, but they haven't allowed the inspections, right? Can you explain the technicality there?
Sure. And you're absolutely right. Most people don't even understand that. So horse slaughter is not illegal in America, but for every piece of meat that comes to your plate, a federal inspector must inspect the animal before he or she dies. That's called ante-mortem inspection, and then after, post-mortem. And those inspectors are federal inspectors paid by the federal government. And in 2007, for the first time, Congress withdrew funding for federal inspection of horses, not for any other animals. But since there's no federal inspectors available for horses, you can't have horse meat produced legally in America for human consumption. In 2011, President Obama signed the budget which actually authorized funding again for inspection of horses for horse meat. And that's when we began our work in earnest to stop that. And it's about a year and a half fight, but we kept the saws from ever starting at any horse slaughter facility in America. And then in 2013, it might be 14, the Congress again prohibited the or took away the funding for horse slaughter inspectors in America. And that prohibition, or what we call a defund, so defunding the money or defunding the inspectors, has been in effect and is still in effect to this day, and even as recently as this week with the recent budget.
Mm-hmm. So that's a victory for us here, for the horses at least, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. The problem is, of course, that horses are still transported across the border, roughly 140,000 a year, to Mexico and Canada to be slaughtered there. So,
and that is definitely still happening.
That is definitely still happening, and that's something else that I've been helping, you know, working on with the folks who do the legislative work. So I do everything I can to support that work by providing whatever insights or documentation or facts or law I can to continue the effort, which has been going on for several years, to get Congress to enact a law that prohibits the transport of animals, horses, over the border for slaughter, because that would shut it down.
And does the same go for the wild burros?
No. Most of the horses I've just been talking about, the horses that get slaughtered, most of them are not wild horses, and they're not wild burros. They're horses who come from the public sector. So they come from basically, I guess you'd say, three areas. One is pet horses who then are sold to auction by their owners when their owners can no longer keep them as pets for whatever reason. A second category is workhorses, so horses who are used on ranches and farms as workhorses and then are retired, but they're not retired, they're sent to slaughter. And the third, of course, is the racing industry, the racehorse industry, which produces far more horses than will ever race, and the excess are sent to slaughter. So that's, and then a tiny, tiny percentage, almost none, except for an occasional blip, are wild horses. The Bureau of Land Management, which oversees the wild horse program, has a policy that prohibits the slaughter for human consumption of wild horses. But every once in a while, or maybe more often than we know, somebody does an end run on that. There was one big bust several years ago of a guy who got 2,000 horses, wild horses, and sent them to slaughter. But technically, that's not happening, and so those horses are not going to slaughter. Where they go to is, and the burros, the wild horses and the burros go to, they are captured from the range in what are known as gathers or roundups, and then taken to what are known as long-term holding facilities, where they mm-hmm. live out their lives in sort of barren corrals compared to the mm-hmm. the range that they grew up on. So the wild horse and burro work is based in a number of federal laws, such as the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and the Administrative Procedures Act.
So I'll finish by asking you a question that I've been asking most people is, in terms of animal welfare, what is giving you the most hope right now?
I don't know. I guess I'd answer by saying it's all pretty sad, but I try to stay hopeful about everything. you know, we're making great strides. Some people think we're either there's nothing being changed or it's not moving fast enough. It's certainly not moving fast enough for people who want things to change. But, you know, we've got 40 chimpanzees at Project Chimps. We've got a cage-free initiative on the ballot in California, or almost on the ballot. People around the country are recognizing that animals should be treated more humanely. So, you know, it's sort of looking up if you look at it the right way.
And you're doing the work you're doing, which is amazing. So my vision is that, too, is that more people recognize that animals are sentient beings and are worthy of our respect and compassion. So hopefully that continues to grow.
Yep, let's hope.
Bruce Wagman, thank you so much for your time today. And I also want to thank our listeners for tuning in. You've been listening to Creating Sanctuary for Animals, and I'm your host, Yolanda Calderon, and I look forward to talking with you all again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.